You mean like that?
No, I don't see that.
Oh,
I'm gonna tell you that.
Okay.
Comment across the table.
That was huge. That was huge. I don't know how they got to your name.
Going to bring the meeting to order. When we finished the other day, we still had some testifiers with regard to the CREP program. And so I'd like to continue with that testimony. And so is Thron Peterson here from Minnesota Farmers Union? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations of the Minnesota Farmers Union. I just wanted to take a few moments of time, too, to also just kind of continue on what we heard last week, that I'm here also to support CREP. And Minnesota Farmers Union also supports CREP. We heard a lot of the good things that we know CREP does, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time rehashing that. We know it's a good program. I also have good feelings about the things it can do after spending a good part of my summer on the G16 Impaired Waters Program. But we are here as Minnesota Farmers Union today to support Representative Queasley's bill or amendment or however he wants to call it, House File 2294, the idea that 120,000 acres and 20% cap on perpetual easements. And that's really what it boils down to, and that's what I'm just going to talk about today. Although I would want to just put in a plug also in the CREP for an idea we've been working on a lot on the grazing issues on CREP, and we're appreciative that that's in the application, although there are some things in the grazing. As the governor talks about needing more livestock in the state, there's a lot of opportunities here, we feel, and the grazing is very important. We've heard that from our members, that in the first Minnesota CREP that some grazing lands were lost, and we want to encourage grazing. That there is a 25% penalty for grazing, but we feel that the USDA can help with an incentive payment. And also the season's a little shorter, too, August 1st to September 15th, and we'd like to see it. We think that CREP agreements, there's room for flexibility in there, and we'd like to see a longer season on the grazing. So it's up in my area, there's not much left in August. So, June 1st to September 15th, I think I've seen Washington State's application. I think it was Colorado's that has a longer season for grazing. So that's my plug for that. On the permanent easement issue, I just was, in doing some research on it, looking at the RFP that came, that the application I think is based on. It says this proposal must provide a discussion of nature of public support, especially from producers. This must include a program for public outreach over the duration of the project. And I just want to say the public support, especially from producers. In crafting this application, putting it together, submitting it, getting all the partners to agree, the farm groups, the citizens of the state, the congressmen, the FSA, USDA, everybody needs to come to the table. But I thought that was an interesting line, especially from producers, and that's who I represent. And I would say the governor, when he crafted it, he did have three meetings out in rural Minnesota, I think during the summertime. I don't know. I think they were in July, where he did have opportunity for farmers, and some of our members did come and talk about the CREP application. But even in our own organization, what happened is we go into our county conventions starting in September, 70-plus county conventions. I attended almost 40 of them, and this was a hot topic in the areas in the northwest, southwest, southeast, and also in the Minnesota River where we already have a CREP agreement. And heard some of the stories, and we had resolutions that are then passed to our state convention, that and we heard more and more concerns about permanency for, you know, various reasons. And farmers were concerned about that, and our members, you know, voted at our state convention after not a lot of debate, frankly, and voted overwhelmingly to support an application that had multiple year options and not, that did not include permanent easements. And I thought it was very interesting, but I listened to farmers who had land in the current CREP. They had land that their neighbors got put into CREP. They had land they want to put in CREP. But in crafting the application, and frankly, we're still in that process. You know, the application can still be worked out. We can still move it forward. Our farmers prefer that the options are multiple-year options that don't include permanent easements. But that being said, we do recognize that there needs to be some permanent easements for wetland restoration, wellhead protection, and perhaps flood mitigation. So that's my message in a nutshell. And I would like to thank Representative Osmond for, you know, trying to work on it with the legacy idea. And we worked on it, we looked at it, and we can't, you know, support it at this time. It would be, you know, going through the process. We have concerns about it, and we would rather stick with our position on this as it has been. So that's my testimony.
Any questions for Phil?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peterson, when you all talk about wellhead protection, is your frame of reference just big public drinking water supplies, or is your frame of reference individual wells?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, and it's quite frankly that the question on wellhead protection hasn't come up within our own organization as much as wetland restoration had. But I think it's the public the wells a lot of times is what you know, people are concerned about. So.
So there isn't an equal concern in the farm community for their own wells? It's just the municipal-type wells?
Again, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I didn't hear a concern raised on that particular issue as much, but I'm sure there's concern for that also.
Mr. Chairman, the only reason I bring it up, I think it's a confusing term, because when people hear it, they hear everybody's well, but it's a term of art that only applies to big municipal well or municipal type wells. But I think when we talk to the public, they think it's everybody's well, and I think that is we have to be careful as we frame it.
Other questions? I have a couple of them with regard to the proposal put out, what we're calling legacy agreement, where we actually have more than just the two options. The two options that you're referring to is one is permanent with regard to wetlands and wellhead protection, flood mitigation, but then there's a 45-year option or a 50-year option, depending upon which one happens to be on the table. And then the whatever is put in place would then come to an end at that point. What I did is I tried to focus on the water protection issue, and recognizing that the waters are the public waters of the state of Minnesota, and that there's a public obligation to protect those waters for our economy and just quality of life here in Minnesota, and that we wanted to have whatever we put in place, we feel we need to have that put in place on a permanent basis, because we have a lot of water in Minnesota, a lot of shoreline. And if we have things limited to 50 years activities with regard to protecting our waters, we're never going to get our waters protected, because we'll be just about the time probably the state will be able to get the revenues and the support to be able to try and protect the waters around the state of Minnesota, they'll have to start all over again. and start going back through again. And the program is actually saying we want to protect public waters. We know that there's an impact from private property onto those public waters. The public will pay the private property person to help us protect the water. But we just want to do that on a one-time basis so the protection is there. But we also want to have flexibility for what's happening on their land. So by focusing on the water protection, we're able to give the flexibility that they are looking at. It wouldn't be a permanent land use restrictions. It would be permanent commitment by the property owner that says that they will help us protect the water. And we can change those activities on the land according to technologies in the future, according to the way options may come about. Of course, the river changes, whatever may happen, those types of things can be changed. But what would be permanent would be the water protection. Do you think your members in your organization are opposed to permanently protecting the waters of the state of Minnesota?
And, Mr. Chairman, I hope not. But, you know, but you know, I don't think they are. But, I you know, and you get into a lot of different and good points there. You know, and one of the arguments that we try not to use or look at a lot of times is that frustrates me. We hear in committees all the time is what do other states do? You know, and what are other states doing? And we know Minnesota is a land of 100 or 12,000 lakes or whatever we have. You know, and I know the importance of that. But in you know, you get down to protecting water, we have a lot of discussions about what is 50 years. What you know, what do we? You know, 50 years to a lot of people does seem like a lot of time. They do feel like things can change a lot in 50 years. So, you know, you get, again, to a lot of the fundamental questions, whether we can or can't do it in 50 years. It's not necessarily what I agree with or what I find, but a lot of my members do feel that 50 years is a long time, you know, in the scope of things. So that's... you know, whether we're protecting it permanently or, you know, to them a lot of times 50 years is permanently. And again, you know, it gets down to all the other arguments on permanent easements, whether we're choosing, you know, what the next generation's going to do. So, you know, and that's some of the concerns.
It seems to me that in a state that relies upon water for our economy, for our quality of life, or just life in general, everything that we really treasure in Minnesota, wildlife, you know, the abilities for people to have recreational opportunities, a lot of it centers around water. And as the pressures build in the future, I think it's going to be even more critical that we have left that legacy to the future generations, that the water is being left to them in as good a condition as we can, as whatever we can afford to do, as we're willing to pay to try and help provide that legacy. But would it be, why is it reasonable that they would then be faced with coming to the same situation over and over again, that we are putting in place water protection, we recognize that's going to be something that we need to have done for as far into the future as there's human life. That's pretty permanent.
That's,
you know, as far as you can see, we're going to need quality waters. So if that's what we're looking at, why would we want to put in programs in place that have to continually go back and reapply those same type of basic fundamental protections? Why would we want to do that?
Well, again, you get to a lot of the reasons. Obviously, we want to clean the waters. We want to, you know, put programs and processes into place, you know, and CREP. And I think a lot of this discussion we do get to our unfortunate, you know, I wasn't around when the first CREP was done and implemented, or I was around, but I wasn't involved in it. But I think a lot of the things we're seeing now are consequences of some of the things or concern that were raised in the first CREP. You know, we talked about, and when we went into the Impaired Waters Program, we talked about one of our ideas is on Farm Bill money, you know, is targeting on the state, you know, targeting Farm Bill money, whether it's EQIP or the new CSP program, to include the Impaired Waters Program and focus a lot of those farm programs on impaired waters. I think we're getting better. I think this CREP application has better things that are targeted to actual, not to say that the first CREP didn't target water quality issues, but I think this application, has things in place, whether it's tracts of land that are, going to, they're not, like we heard, like 160 acres out, that's not, shouldn't have been in CREP. This CREP plan, will address a lot of those issues and be targeted more towards helping water, so that maybe in 50 years, the water is improved enough that in cases that, land can come out. I'm not saying it will or not, but, that's certainly an argument. The other idea, too, is that, we raise sometimes, too, is farming practices change. What's the world going to look like in 50 years? What's a crop we might not even know that we're going to grow someday? We might, the land, there might be something on that land we could grow or use 50 years from now. 50 years ago, we didn't plant soybeans to the magnitude we plant them now. We planted a lot more hay and cover crops, and we don't know what farming practices will look like 50 years from now. And there may be a use for that land that would be good for the economy and good for the areas. And so that, I don't disagree with what you're saying, in a sense, and I understand it, but those are some of the concerns, that may be raised on that and reasons why we wouldn't want to, put that land away permanently. So,
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me put it this way. Will your members agree to use only native species in restoration, or do they want to use non-natives?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we really haven't discussed that, so I couldn't answer that. I don't think that they would use the native species. They would use the native species, but I can't answer that for sure. It hasn't been discussed.
Just a few comments, not necessarily a question, but I live in the Minnesota River Valley where the first CREP sign up was, and I'll try and explain a little bit why the backlash on the permanent easements. In my area, there were some farms where whole farms went into CREP, and I'll give you one example. It was 160 acres with about a little over 30 acres of wetland on it, but the whole 160 acres went into CREP. And there was three brothers, dairy farmers, that were renting that farm, and they told me that they could understand the logic to putting the wetland in and maybe even a few acres around it, but for the whole farm to go in really irritated them. They lost 25% of their tillable acres in that one application. Another problem that I think happened is that we ended up with a sign-up period that was way too short, so the SWCDs, when they were taking applications, I don't believe they had enough time to target those applications to where they were really needed and did the most good, thus ending up with some whole farms. When I look at the total acres that were enrolled and divided by the applications, I think it was a little less than 40 acres average if you did it that way, which means that whole farms was really not the rule but probably the exception, except those whole farms that were enrolled, they stuck out like sore thumbs in the neighborhood. I think that's part of the backlash. Tom brought up the grazing. I think if that were had been included in the first one, that if some of that land could have actually had some productive use yet after application, I think that would have helped also. Another issue is that when you added up the total payment that the farmers got when they enrolled their land into CREP, it actually went above the market value of the land at that time. I think now the land is catching up to that, but there's some irritation, too, about government outbidding private bidders, and I think those are some of the irritations. Once again, I think if the enrollment period had been longer so that they could have done a better job of targeting those dollars to do the most good, I think that the backlash wouldn't have been as serious as it was.
And President Cohen, I think you're right on target with your impressions of where the problems came from. The frustration I'm having is that I've tried to address each one of those problems, and I've handed out some proposed language. I gave the other day, gave an outline, and this is trying to put that into kind of writer language. But I'd like to just take a moment and kind of walk through it to show you how we've attempting to address those issues, and that when we get through the number item three here in the conservation legacy in which the practices must be maintained. This would be after 35 years. In other words, we start out in this CREP program. The first 15 years are underneath CRP, and that is somewhat problematic in the fact that CRP really idles the land completely. And I think we need to have some flexibility there so that we only idle what is absolutely necessary or needed in order to provide the water quality. And then we really focus the whole program on providing permanent water quality. And the land that should be even evaluated to go into this program should be land that has direct impact on the water quality. So that's why we're targeting highly erodible lands or very marginal crop lands. And we try to reference some methods to identify those. And we're saying that those lands also need to be within a third of a mile of the of state public waters, so we don't have property that is a significant distance from the water, yet it's marginal cropland, but they put it into the program when we're really trying to take limited number of dollars and really stretch it out across the state of Minnesota to provide the biggest impact we can on our water quality in the state. And so then the and then to address the issue of not having adequate time to deal with this, not only did they get off track with regard to lands that kind of were eligible and put it in, and so they didn't really get the scrutiny that they should have, I think there's also some potential that people really didn't get the background information that they really needed in order to make good quality decisions themselves as property owners. And so we're saying that the contractual agreement between the landowner and the local soil and water conservation district, and that's who we'd have is really dealing with what's going to happen on this land long term to protect the water quality, is getting that at the local level rather than dealing with the state level through Bowser. And the that this conservation would include a conservation plan that clearly identifies the methods used to maintain the public water quality protection. That's why I think sometimes CRP just blanketly applied may go too far, and we can hopefully we can get some more flexibility in that. But once the 15 years has passed, we certainly would then have the state ability to really target the activities that are going to impact on the water quality, hay or grazing rights, drainage pathways, water flow management of neighboring properties should be included in that conservation plan, because we had situations where the wetland was being restored, but it's my understanding that neighboring properties' waters used to flow through that area, and when the tiles got broken up to support the wetland, that was fine for the land that was actually in the contract. But then when more water came along, it starts to impact on the neighbors' properties and their ability to drain their lands. So those issues really need to be resolved before we enter into the contract, so that neighbors' impacts on neighboring properties is taken into account. Always focusing on the water protection, and these agreements should not alter any existing legal drainage rights of non-enrolled landowners. And in item C, showing that the landowner choosing to buy could choose a buyback provision, so that after 35 years, that would be 15 years of CRP and 20 years of CREP. After 35 years, they would then be up to the Soil and Water Conservation District to evaluate if new technologies have occurred, if the river has changed course, if there were management activities that are occurring or available to us at that time or to the people that are here at that time, that they can take all those into account because it's really water quality protection we're trying to purchase. Many times underneath the federal agricultural programs, it's idling the land that was the goal, because they're also trying to control crop production. This program is not targeted to control crop production. It's targeted to control water quality. And so by focusing on the water quality, we can let people have their production rights if they, as long as they maintain the water quality. And that's what I've tried to focus on, is let's provide permanent water quality so that when we take care of a one-mile stretch on a riverbank, we don't have to go back 50 years from now and have to do it again, or who is ever here has to pay to have it taken care of again. That we really have a commitment by the property owners that the water quality protection is something that it's paid for, and it's something that they will have to acknowledge and deal with as they then have flexibility to change the uses of their property over the years. And the so that's why, and this would all be in a contractual agreement, so that if you have identified what the water quality protections are that that the state is really trying to purchase, that way the professionals 50 years from now or 35 years from now will be able to help to determine what technologies can be put in place that can provide that same level of protection, so that we know exactly what it is that we're buying. And then and they know what it is that they're selling and agreeing to provide. A landowner choosing this option may deduct the cost of providing the public water quality protection measures or flood damage reduction benefits from the appraised value of the land. So when they go to buy it back, the value of those production rates is valued again, the appraisal is taken, and if there's costs that need to be imposed in order to maintain the water quality, they can deduct that from the price, because we're not trying to have a program that just idles the land. We're trying to have a program that focuses on the water quality. Therefore, if we get the water quality, they can have their production rights back. So that's the money that's collected, though, from this would go into a conservation fund, because we know that when we idle the land, one of the biggest benefits we get from that is habitat. And so we don't want to eliminate our concern for habitat, but we also want to leave the flexibility for whatever the future holds for the activity that goes on that property. So we'll take those dollars from any buyback, put it into a conservation fund so that more conservation lands can be purchased for habitat out of those funds in the future. So this is, going on down through the last point is, before any agreement for an easement of clauses 1 to 3 can occur, a written landowner bill of rights must be prepared by the Board of Water and Soil Resources and given to the interested landowner. And that's so people will understand what their options are, and we don't want people to enter into these programs with false impressions or a bad understanding, because this is something that we want to have established that will be on that property for as far into the future as government is existing in the state of Minnesota. And so knowing that, we certainly don't want people to enter into these programs frivolously or with lack of knowledge, understanding of its long-term impact, but it also of its long-term benefits, and that means protecting of the quality of the water in the state of Minnesota. That's the option that I put out there, and it's caused some movement, because it has tried to resolve the very points that you've raised, as well as the concerns that Mr. Peterson has brought up, as well as those that Mr. Christofferson mentioned the other day when he was here. We're just not quite able to get past some of the, I'll say the political barriers that we have established by digging in so deeply on trying to express the frustrations that people have had in the past application of a program. Even when we're able to make changes to adjust those, things are still dug in so deep, they're having a difficult time moving it. So I'm hopeful that we will be able to move this on our committee and have it attached to the bonding bill as a rider, so that we can continue this conversation and work it out over a period of time. Because I think that there's PREP programs, extremely valuable program, but protecting our waters and having some confidence in what we're doing today and the money that we're willing to invest today as taxpayers will have some impact on the quality of the water for my great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. That's really what I'm trying to get established here. Representative Conan, I think you were
dealing
with your issues.
I would just like to say that I hope there's some kind of we can reach some kind of agreement so that there is a CREP program. And I'd also like to add that I think if the first CREP program would have had a lot of this stuff in it, that we wouldn't have seen the backlash that we're seeing now. And also, I like about this, the targeting the water quality stuff, that's going to cost a lot of money in the future. And I know I'm a Farmers Union member. I was actually at the convention where this passed. And normally, Farmers Union is fairly, fairly receptive to conservation things. But the cost of this clean water programs in the future is going to cost a lot of money, and we could be looking at things like fees on feet of tile line, that kind of stuff, and I think that that should be a concern for farmers also, and some of this could actually offset some of those possible fees in the future.
And one of the reasons I want to really try and get us working on this type of an approach is because we are looking at just the tip of the iceberg. This is a CREP program that is really dealing with the permanent easement issue. But when we look at impaired waters and the impaired that's mandated by the federal government and that program coming into play, and we're going to be dealing with that as a state for years, if not generations to come, and as we try to put in place mechanisms to meet the obligations of fixing the impaired water issues, we're going to run into permanent easement issues time and time and time again. And so I'm hoping we can start to set up a model to get around the land use easements that would have some flexibility, but yet we focus on our objective, and that's to have positive impact on our waters. Because if we can start a model like this, not only would it be beneficial for the state of Minnesota, I think this is occurring all across the country. This is not something that's just a local issue. Permanent easements and backlash to permanent easements is happening from a property rights standpoint all across the country. But the public waters are the public waters, and the private land has negative impact on public waters. We need to address that, and somehow we've got to resolve that issue. And if it doesn't get resolved in a way that we can be supporting programs like CREP, where it's a cooperative effort between the public and the private landowner, and there's sharing of costs in resolving the problems, someday government's going to turn just to regulation, and they're going to say, we don't care what if you want to do this or not, here's what you're going to have to do. And then we lose all flexibility, because then you're sitting in a prescriptive actions that are going to dictate as to what happens on a piece of property, whether that property is, it makes common sense on that property or not. And I don't even want to go down that path. So I think it's really all of our benefit to try and work on something that we can get the impact on this in a very positive way. Do you have any follow-up, Rick?
No, I just I agree with that. That your statement that there could be just plain regulation in the future that says this is what you're going to do, here there's actually some local control and even landowner decisions that can be made. This is a better way to do it than just having being somewhere down in the future, who knows, 10, 20 years, just said this is what you're going to do, period.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really, really want to extend a real thank you from myself for the hard work you're doing. I know it's been frustrating. Sometimes we've been running against some really people that on both sides, just inflexibility, and I commend you for your hard work. And I just want to preface it, Mr. Peterson, in the context of I'm someone who owns 120 acres on the shores of the Vermilion River, a designated trout stream approximately 3 miles upriver from me. Terrific improvement has happened on this small river. It's 120 acres that 100 acres of it is table flat. You couldn't pick a better land to be in production of bald and burlap tree production. It's terrific. 20 acres of it gradually slopes down to the waterways. And certainly the 10 acres closest to the water would be a great candidate for a program like this. And I got to tell you that I think this is an opportunity for us as farmers to realize we are never going to have an opportunity like this again. There's information out there today that is telling us what phosphorus is doing. And a lot of us that are using the land have an opportunity here to do corrective action and set aside highly erodible lands, a very small percentage of those, in easements that will protect that land. And I was very encouraged to hear you say that you're interested that the farming practices may change long term. Maybe the best thing in 40 years is going to be to harvest the wildflower seeds with to plant more prairie, and that we're going to make big money. I mean, who would ever guess this flat 120 acres that we're growing trees on that was always in soybean and corn production would change? When my neighbors are growing ginseng or they're growing vegetables or they're growing potatoes, it was all corn and beans. Times are changing and they're going to continue to change. And I'm very encouraged to hear what you have to say. And I hope when you leave this room, you're going to go up to the corner of the fourth floor and lock yourself in a room with about three other people. And like Representative Coonan, Chairman Osmond, and myself would say, this is an opportunity that is never, ever, ever going to be before us again. And we have a chance to save and really protect the environment and do good things and keep us in agriculture and keep us doing what myself and the Suffolks next to me, a family farm, a dairy farm that no longer milks cows because it can't work and they've had to get out of that business. We want to keep our viable rural economy growing, and this is a great opportunity. And I commend you for being here and to say that you're interested, that you understand things are going to change in the future. And I really hope that that your group has an open mind and will continue to work like it looks like you're willing to do, because this is an opportunity that in another day or two we could lose, and we don't want to lose this. This is a terrific opportunity, and I thank you for your willing to listen to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you're writing your model, I would encourage you to put one additional mechanism in it. And because you are concentrating on waters, we do not want to get ourselves in the position of having to deal with another purple loosestrife. And I think that is, we don't want to do that. I mean, we talked about it yesterday. We could keep ourselves out of that by saying the plantings will be native, particularly since you're going into more wetlands, water things. You're going to be by the edge of the water where we know things can spread just lickety-split, that we should say all native species, Minnesota native species, because then we will never have that invasive issue. We will never have that cleanup issue. We won't have all the spores that we heard about yesterday popping out. And as I remember, if I remember correctly, in RIM, it was planted in native species. That was either we paid a premium for it, I think that's what we did, but most of it was in native species.
Mr. Peterson.
I really have a comment on that. I don't know, but I appreciate that comment too. Obviously, we don't kudzu farms or anything. So, can I comment on your legacy one last time, and then
sure.
And I just want to make it clear too that I appreciate everything that's in here, because I see a lot of real positive things, and I, you know, and Farmers Union really wants to move CREP forward. We would like to get it done. You know, we lobby on our policy statement, and we put this out to our members, and we haven't got a, you know, clear, definite statement back at this time, you know, on this issue. There are things in here, and maybe this is the way you go eventually. You know, and I don't know if it would take us a year or it would take us 2 days, but I think it'll take us some time to sort this out, and that's the issue we're having with it. I see a lot of good things in here, and I'm wondering if I think you've even changed part of the way the landowner buys it back from the original provision I saw on the appraised value, and I think it was more on how you went into the program at one time. I'm not sure on that, but so I do appreciate this, and But we also, you know, like I say, too, there's a lot of other, well, there's two congressmen and there's a FSA state technical or state committee that looks at this. And I hope that, you know, in trying to move this forward, that, you know, that there's still some issues there with that also. And, you know, I don't think I need to, you know, keep on that. But, you know, those are a lot of the issues we're sorting through with those folks also. So it's you know, a wide-ranging topic still. So
I appreciate that. And I know the difficulty that we're having with, because of the multiple areas that people, or jurisdictions, I guess, that are been trying to negotiate or work on this issue. And when people, when the resolutions passed, I think that kind of gave everyone a real sense of direction and camaraderie in what they were trying to attempt for a goal. And then heated discussions in the process kind of locked people into their positions. And now we're trying to get towards something that may really be a long-term benefit and really a different paradigm as to how we've been dealing with this issue. I know it's very difficult to back up and restart on those things. So the only thing I can do is try and keep moving forward as best we can, and with your help, keep massaging you know, the words that we use to carry out our objectives so that they can become more acceptable. But it is... I know that the commitment or concern that people have about permanent easements with regard to land controls, but I have to tell you, I'm just as committed with regard to trying to provide permanent protection for the public waters. And I've asked Ms. Christofferson the other day, who agreed that public waters need to be protected, as well as maintain the flexibility for the property owner in that, providing that protection. And I said, well, how do I get there? You know, what do I do? I've done as much as I have the knowledge or capacity to create. Be creative. I don't know what else to do. I'm wide open for suggestions. So appreciate you continuing to work on it. And I know that we all share the same goals. It's just a matter of trying to get there. Person McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Maybe it'd be helpful for some folks if you explain the kudzu problem, because if I, that's what you referenced, right?
What's that?
Didn't you reference the kudzu problem?
Yeah.
And perhaps you, it would be helpful if you explained to folks what that was, because that was planted for conservation.
Right. I happen to live in, my folks moved from Minnesota to Georgia at one time and bought a farm there, and, you know, kudzu's everywhere. Kudzu's was planted for, brought from the east, far east, for, you know, they thought it would be a good thing, and now it's everywhere. Anybody that's been in Georgia, and goats will eat it, but, you know, other than that, it's a big problem, so.
And that was planted, Mr. Chairman, with the best of intentions, but it was not native.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, people were thought they were doing the right thing. I hope we can avoid that.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Roger Pedersen. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Pedersen. I know it sounds Pedersen looking at it, but Pedersen is always been by it.
No, and I thought that's the way it was, and then I saw it written here, and I changed it. I should have.
That's okay. In this state, Pedersen with a D is not so uncommon. You can find it. I work for Ducks Unlimited. I'm the Director of Conservation Programs for Minnesota and Iowa. And we're very interested in this issue with CREP and permanent easements. Permanent easements are a big part of our conservation program throughout the country, particularly in the Dakotas. And we're using easements to buy a portion of the rights from landowners, and they're very receptive to that particular option. It gives them an opportunity to recover some equity back in their land. It also gives producers an opportunity to take some land out of production. But it seems that the way the economy or the economics of the Farm Bill work, it drives them to put more and more land in, even land that they acknowledge probably shouldn't be farmed. So to have a voluntary perpetual easement is a good thing. And DU supports the CREP, and we support permanent easements, and we would like to thank the chairman for his efforts in trying to get some resolution on CREP. From our point of view, when we looked at Minnesota, when we do business plans, we do a resource assessment. And what we found in Minnesota is that the lakes, the rivers, the streams, and the wetlands have all been degrading and deteriorating over the last, say, 20, 25 years, now to the point that the wetlands themselves are unable to support waterfowl populations even when they migrate through the state. And so what it's led is that we have hunters in Minnesota who now have, they don't see the waterfowl hunting like they used to see it. And they're going to other states, particularly North Dakota, and where there is an abundant wetland base, a lot of ducks, there's a lot of land that's in grass cover, either through rangeland or CRP, and with it has come a phenomenal wildlife boom. And so we have a lot of hunters going over to that state, and it's created a bit of dispute there. Resident hunters, I was in Bismarck for 5 years prior to moving back here in Minnesota, and it was split right in our DU office right down the line. 50% of the guys who were residents of North Dakota didn't want to see non-residents come over, and the people of us who were non-residents that came over thought it was a great idea. There's all these abundant wildlife populations, we should have access to it. And it seemed that the situation in this state is we have a landscape, particularly in the prairie and prairie transition, that's going in the wrong direction. The water quality is deteriorating, the ability of that land to support wildlife is diminishing, and we need to find ways to change it around. And I guess what we would look at, there's going to be a variety of conservation tools that are going to be required. Some of that is going to be permanent in terms of either easements with private landowner, fee title ownership by public agencies, short-term easements or incentives, or such things as civic responsibility. I grew up on a dairy farm, and my dad did stuff that he just thought it was the right thing to do. We have a creek that ran through our farm, and he didn't plow down through that. He didn't want to get close to it. He knew that it was going to erode away, so he just didn't do it. And that was, I think all these things are going to have to come to play to change the situation around in Minnesota. So in summary with this, I would say that if there is some way that we can find a solution, I appreciate this buyback provision. I would offer a word of caution with buyback provisions. That's new enough, and it's unfamiliar enough with a lot of the conservation organizations that they want to study it pretty closely and see how that affects, at least from DU point of view, how that would affect our program in other states. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions, Ms. Peterson? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, this may be a question to you instead, and that's on the buyback provision, and that's how it figures in the value of money. Now, I understand in some parts of the state, the value of land is probably going up faster than the value of money, so that when you buy back at the appraised value of the land, that's probably getting enough of a profit, you know, with the other things that come off. But in other states, you've got in other parts of the state, the value of land may not be going up. And I don't know if this, I know nothing about real estate, so I don't know if this is true. I just kind of think it's true. And so therefore, the value of the money that you gave people a long time ago is much greater than the value of the money when you're paying it back. So I wonder if there should be, in terms of buying back, looking at the also paying back the increase in the value of the money.
Kind of try to address that, in that the concept here is that property would be appraised both at the time of entry into the program, so it would be current dollars, and at the time that it would be, people would like to buy portions of those rights back, 35 years from now, the appraisal would occur at that time, and so whatever the value of those rights as they would be inflated, I would assume, unless there's something happens economically, if it does, it would go down the other way. But they would be actually, the actual value of the right would be the market price.
What I'm saying is that this language captures the increase in the value of the land appropriately. What it doesn't capture is the fact that there's also an increase in the value of the money. The present day value of $1 million, for example, spread over 20 years, is a lot less than $1 million. It's what the lottery does, and I think we maybe ought to do with some of these. The lottery advertises $1 million prize. In order to take it to get it as $1 million prize, you have to accept that in payments over 20 years. If you say no, I want it, which amazingly enough, absolutely everybody does. If you say, I want the money right, I think you get $350,000, something like that. You get the present-day value of what $1 million is. But the lottery won't give up. You know, I've tried several times to make them advertise that lower number in their product. You know, that's the truth in government, that you're taking it. You know, and I assume that the people, when they make their decision, get full information on it. But, you know, it seems to me that that kind of concept of how the value of money appreciates, not only the value of land, also could be applied to this place. The difference between a lump sum payment and payments over a period of time. And if we're trying to sell a program, you should probably follow the lottery's example and sell it by talking about what the value is in the spread out configuration rather than just the lump sum configuration. You've captured the cases where the value of land changes. The value of money never goes down, by the way. But you've captured, except in countries, South American countries or something like that. you've captured the what will happen logistically up or down to the value of land, but you haven't done captured what happens to the change in the value of money. And I think I don't know enough to really do this, but yeah. You know, there are people around here who do, bankers and people like that, who can tell you how you could structure this language so you also capture the increase in the value of money. Or use the fact that a lump sum payment differs from payments over a long period of time, you know, in the same way that the lottery does.
The incentive would be to try, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that if we're giving them a dollar today, it actually...
that dollar is worth more than the dollar 20 years from now.
Okay. And that would be, to me, would be an indication for them to enter into the program, because that's really an incentive for them. And we made that a little clearer.
A disincentive to get out of it, because they then have to pay back from the money that, besides the land, they have to pay back the money that they got on what the increased value of that money is. In other words, if they got a dollar 20 years ago, 20 years later, they'd have to pay back the present day value of that dollar, which might very well be $3, not.
What I'm hesitant to go in that direction. We'll talk some more about it, and I may not have a good understanding as to what it accomplished.
These people like it very much. But there are two parts to that. One, using the lottery concept of giving the total value of something even when people only accept the present-day value, and then going back by making them pay back at the present-day value instead of the earlier value.
Because my expectation would be that there... probably very little, because we're trying to really target this towards marginal lands in the first place, because it's so difficult to, I would expect anyway, and you never know what technology can do or what can happen in the future. I think it's probably going to be very difficult for them to find a mechanism to be able to actually provide the protection of the water better than what we're doing right at this present time. So it's a buyback option there so that people understand there's flexibility. But it's also to try and get people to recognize that we want to have permanent protection of the water. And as long as we get permanent protection of the water, we're willing to pay today's price for it. And if that happens to be of some financial benefit to them in the future, I have no problem with that. Especially if that encourages them to get into the program. So, but we'll talk some
more. Well, you know, I gave you two things: one to encourage them, and one to get our money back. Our money's worth back when we get it back. So, one to encourage getting into it, and one to discourage buyback. That's what it's about.
Are there any questions of?
Can I offer a comment on
please.
Economic?
Yes.
Well, Ducks Unlimited has found it, particularly in the Dakotas and places like Iowa, lands that were formerly ag ground that were entered into a permanent easement program, whether it was a federal wetland reserve program or the state, like the RIM wetland reserve program here, In many cases, those lands become very attractive to people who are interested in hunting or for some other use. In essence, the landowner gets almost fee value for the easement to begin with, and then he can sell it to somebody who will pay him almost fee value again for the use of that land for recreation. And at least in our definition, when we talk working lands, I understand the agricultural concept, but with wildlife people, a 120-acre piece of property that was converted back to, say, warm season native prairie grass, we would call that working lands for the fact it's producing wildlife populations that generate a renewable economic resource.
Representative Guineas.
Yeah, could you expand on the hunters renting land for hunting?
Renting land?
Well, isn't that what you said?
Well, they do lease land. Hunters will lease land for hunting, but they'll also purchase it. Depends on the species. Species like pheasants, deer, and turkeys that are resident become pretty attractive. Pieces of, or parcels that hold those animals become pretty attractive to hunters. And if these kind of programs are any close to a population center, I'm sure that the recreational value of them in terms of hunter opportunity or just getting out and into nature is pretty high.
Okay, let me phrase it. Are these lands going to be open to the public, or can the farmer rent the land out for hunting, was my question, really.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe under this program, access is not included. It's up to the landowner. They would sign an easement to protect certain values of that land, and once that's done, if they can then lease it for hunting, that's their prerogative to do so.
I think that's the point I was getting to. I would think that, but just leasing it for hunting, you could do it for just one season or something like that. Is that what you could say? And that would be a valuable asset for a farmer.
Correct. It would be a valuable asset.
Can you put a number on it?
No, I can't. And it generally would relate to how attractive the property is to wildlife and how good the hunting is. The better the hunting, the more the hunter would be willing to pay. Or as close to an urban center, for example, so there's more people have access to that particular tract. Probably determine the monetary value of a hunting opportunity that's there.
Mr. Peterson, I think it'd be fair to say that very often when we have habitat developed on a property that may have been cropped in the past, that the land may become more valuable as a hunting activities and for leasing for hunting purposes than it would if it was still cropped.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
But it's one of those economic benefits of, that goes along with this type of program that everyone kind of wins on the situation. So it's other questions of Mr. Peterson, Representative Cornish?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a question as a comment. I'll let them ask the question and get to my comment later.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak for or against the CREP proposal? Okay. Mr. Harnack, could you just give us kind of a quick I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
We were up
there.
Sorry
about that. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lance Ness, and I have with me today John Shores on behalf of MOA, and we want to encourage our support of this bill and, again, really thank the chairman of the committee for working so hard to come to a compromise. Again, we just want to point out this is a volunteer program. It's a very important program. This, combined with some of the other things we've been talking about in front of your committee, wildlife management acquisition and the quarter percent proposals, we think will go a long way towards cleaning up our water. But this is an important part because it includes federal dollars. And about the term and the long-term length of these things, we do want to point out we didn't get in this situation in 50 years or in 25 years. We've been farming these lands for over 100 years now. And it's not that easy just to turn around and change those things. So we want to point that out to the community. It took a long time to get in this position. It's probably going to take a long time to get back out of it.
I would would echo Lance's sentiments, and I'm here to throw the weight of MOHA behind this effort, and we do thank Representative Osmond for his hard work. Supplementals, you've been really done a great job of explaining, and it's been an enlightening experience here. It's an honest effort and a good compromise, and we need those dollars. So, MOHA fully supports this effort.
Thank you very much. Any questions from him? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Mr. Harnack or Director Harnack or Mr. Lyons, whichever would prefer to come up, or both of you, I'd just like to ask a couple questions with regard to the legacy. You've had a chance to see the language that we have here. Is there anything that you can identify that needs to be taken care of at this time, or does this seem to cover what we have discussed with regard to a legacy program?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me, Kevin Lyons with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board. I'd like to comment on Representative Wagenius' earlier questions regarding the use of native vegetation. The CREFs do require the use of native vegetation for permanent plantings, so that is the focus of this initiative, and it was as well in the Minnesota River, as I might add as well. But that point is covered within the initial application, and I would expect would be retained within the memorandum of agreement.
And Mr. Chairman, right, just the issue of grazing and haying of these lands has come up, and we've had some discussions with folks about greater flexibility on grazing. And I think we need to acknowledge that the grazing that is done on these lands is for purposes of perpetuating the native vegetation. It is not something that is done just as a wholesale grazing practice. There would have to be a grazing management plan on these lands as required by statute for that kind of activity to be provided for. But there are only a few options for managing these lands, particularly when we put native plantings on it. It costs us more to put them on the ground. It's important to do that. But also then we need to manage them so that you do not have invasive species enter into it. And the traditional way has been burning. And we believe that appropriately we should be including grazing, and then maybe some limited degree of haying could be allowed for it too, while protecting the integrity of the water quality and the habitat that these lands were taken for in the first place.
With regard to grazing, rotational grazing is something that I believe is a very good conservation effort on many of the lands that we're talking about, or at least on some of them. And I would assume, though, that we have some flexibility with regard to the type of livestock and so forth, that and the type of grasses that would be used there. They don't have to. Are we locking them down the choices on this program so that people can't go into a managed rotational grazing program?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I just want to remind the group again that this is a combined program. When in fact we get our CREP agreement done in Minnesota, we have to use the criteria and guidelines of the continuous CRP program, and then we merge them with what the state is going to put forth as our CREP application. So it's not that we can just totally craft absolute flexibility that we maybe would like or need. And that was one of the problems, for example, in the Minnesota River. In the CRP program, which is the first 15 years of the program, haying and grazing is not allowed on CRP acres, with the exception under an emergency declaration. So under that scenario, that practice was not allowable. CRP has been changed and modified in the 2002 Farm Bill that now does allow a provision for haying and grazing on certain practice types or eligible lands. So whether or not we would have total flexibility to allow rotational grazing on all acres enrolled, I couldn't tell you that at the moment for positive, but the problem would not be the state easement part of that. We could allow that after the 15-year period has expired on the federal side. Haying and grazing under a rotational conservation plan could be allowed.
Okay. Members, I had a chance this summer, and I believe some of you may have been there also, at, have seen some rotational grazing in southern Minnesota. I think it was on an LCMR tour. But the, boy, I was just very impressed as to the quality of the coverage and how it is maintained, and because it is limited in as far as the how much time that the livestock can be on the land before it's moved to another location, really seemed to me to be a good way to provide conservation and economic benefit at the same time. So it was something I certainly wanted to see continue. So glad to hear we have some more flexibility in that, and that the federal guidelines will actually be the lead, take the lead on that issue. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure Mr. Lyons or Mr. Harnack, which one of you, so I understand, because mowing or haying or grazing of the grasses of in the establishment of native prairie is very beneficial. When we're establishing native prairie in our business, it's recommended to be cut the first few years for good establishment. Did I understand that the CRP will not allow that? So that, and then it does allow the burning. If we can't mow it, we are able to burn, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the provisions for mowing, you know, is different for the establishment of the conservation practices versus once those. It's in CRP. It's a 3-year window. You have that opportunity to do whatever mechanism you need to obviously establish the conservation practices, but then the restriction would be in place at that, from that time forward. In the old CRP, now they have modified the requirements in the federal program so that there's actually mid-contract management practices. In fact, every new landowner enrolling into CRP would have to do some management practices to maintain their conservation practices, and or you could opt to do haying and grazing a certain portion of the acre. So a lot has changed from the previous farm bill. So, however, it does require presently a reduction in payment to hay or graze, a 25% reduction through CRP.
Just real quick follow-up. So the mowers can be Holstein cows, but it'll be a reduction in the payment?
My understanding presently under federal CRP rules that there would be required reduction under that scenario. You know, within our CREP application, we could submit for waivers or exceptions or new inclusions, and, you know, take to see what how USDA would respond with our request.
Well, that would seem to be, thank you, Mr. Chair, that would seem to be a reasonable request, because I don't know if it makes more sense just to mow it and throw the grass away if we got some Holstein cows that want to eat it and it's going to help the establishment of the native prairie. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, just additional on that is, even when you hay it, in order to promote the propagation, you need to remove that residue. So that's why burning or grazing is a better option than just clipping it and leaving it lay. You still need to get it off the land for the promotion of those natives. And we would like to see it as an incentive for management of that land, and to have that reduced payment eliminated. And we've had some of those discussions as part of the CREP application, and hopefully it's something we could accommodate.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Members, I'd like to bring up Representative Cox. Representative Cox had we talked about his bill. He explained it the other day, House File 2249. It should be in your packets yet, or there somewhere. It was the basic House file asking for the funding for the CREP program. And Representative Cox, I'll move House File 2249. I'd also like to amend to it the rider language that we have, if that's okay with you. Have you had a chance to take a look at the rider language I put together, the legacy CREP?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have, and I support this legacy CREP option, and I thank you for your work that you've done on this, by trying to come to a point where we can all agree on conservation practices to protect the public water and realize that we're addressing concerns for forever. And I think this does that, and I am supportive of this.
Okay. And thank you very much for all of your efforts on this, and your work and cooperation, and teamwork goes a long way. So thank you very much.
Appreciate it does. Thank you.
Are there any questions on the rider language? I'll make a motion that we include the rider language as House File 2249. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 2249 will be laid over for inclusion in the Bonnie Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, we have Representative Cornish.
I support the CREP naturally, wholeheartedly, but I just wanted to us to consider a couple of things as we're deliberating on this. Is one is, before you think the farmers are running off with a lot of money and this is a great deal, which it is, when we're talking about leasing land, these are a lot of times small tracts and you aren't going to get people to lease them. And the other thing is that a lot of farmers hunt themselves, don't want to other people in there and tramping over their land. And the other thing I haven't been able to resolve is the tax issue. We're giving them one payment forever, but taxes are forever, and I've got a county that's taxing right now the CREP land at the same rate as agricultural land, and that kind of bothers me. And maybe as a committee we could send a letter to the Department of Revenue, because they've been hanging around for 2 years now without giving an answer. A county assessor wrote in and asked for determination. They said one was coming, and it still hasn't. There is statute that's supposed to give CREP land a reduction, but it doesn't say how much. So some counties aren't abiding by that, and they're taxing them at ag land rates, where other counties are taxing them at wasteland rates. So I think that's one thing that we have to address, is get the tax issue worked out for the future. So that's about it.
Mr. Gibson, I think you're right on target. One of the things that will make these programs, as we're dealing with impaired waters issues in the future, is that we have something settled with regard to how we're going to deal with the tax issues. And Department of Revenue has not presented guidelines to the counties, so therefore it's all over the board as to how counties are handling this situation. Some of it's in the benefit and in that helps our efforts with regard to protecting the environment, and some of those efforts for some of the counties' efforts seem to be working counter to what we're trying to accomplish. So we really need to try and work that out. Won't be able to do that today, though, but we can pass or approve our minutes from our last meeting, March 2nd. Representative Hoppe will move approval of those minutes.
Yes, sir.
Any additions or corrections? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. And members, we will be, we're going to recess, and we will be coming back together later this afternoon, where it will be following whatever happens in policy committee. As I understand, Representative Hackbarth, you're going to be trying to deal with issues and finish up at noon. If we're not, then you're going to carry into the afternoon. And then when you're completed, we will then carry forward after that. And then, so this afternoon, we will be in room 300 South, either first with policy and then finance, or with finance. So we will let you know at the end of the policy committee when we will actually be able to reconvene. But we are in recess to call the chair. meeting to order. We have passed out the environmental capital budget recommendations that I've put together. And I'd like to go down or through the document just a little bit to have it described to you, and then we can, so that you'll have an idea as to how this is made some selections as well as how it's actually put together. But first on its layout, I thought I'd just have Mr. Reinholz just go over the layout, and then I'll talk about specific projects after that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this spreadsheet, just to explain to you what you're looking at here a little bit, you've seen it before without the proposals in there, but what I have here is laid out in the column, obviously titled Governor's Rec, what the governor recommended for the various projects listed over in the first column. If you move over then into the column, bills heard in Environment Finance Committee, those are specific bills heard on the topics listed in the project title column. They are lined up, grouped together in like subjects. The first grouping, as you can see, is the flood hazard mitigation grants. They are lined up with the governor's rec where that's appropriate to match up with what was in the bill. If it is slightly different, in this case, different flood hazard mitigation grants, they follow the governor's recommendation. And then over in the column titled proposal number one, that is the proposal before you, the total dollars recommended for that project activity. What's in the last column, which says there is included in Maine, and what it means is it is included in the total recommended for the Maine project. So in the first case, in the flood hazard mitigation grants, the governor recommended $20 million. This proposal recommends $23,600,000. Included in that proposal, then, would be $3,575,000 of identified projects. If you follow down and then backwards, it would be House File 2182 for $3,400,000 and House File 2345, the Cannon Falls project, for $175,000, along with the governor's record, is what makes up the proposal recommendation of the $23,600,000. So that same structure follows through on the recommendations. You can see what would be the main project total, and then within that project, and probably identified in riders, would be some individual items underneath those totals. Mr. Chairman, I could add in summary, if you look at the total dollar amount, the governor's recommendations were $144,369,000 from all funds, and it's exactly the same total in the proposal recommended here. If you would like me to go through the individual items, Mr. Chairman, and just to name what they are, I'm not sure if you wanted me to do that or not at this time, I could do that.
I think you, yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that. And if there's something people have questions on anything as we go through, bring up those questions. Representative Wagenius. Yeah, pull that right around. Move it out of the way.
But I did.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, tell us about your intention here tonight. Are we just reviewing, or what is your plan?
We're making recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee. The communications have gone out in email and so forth, and questions have gone out in email and so forth, and we're also to not only give them the recommendations with regard to dollar amounts, but also to try and prioritize items, what has our strongest support versus weaker support. This particular document doesn't have a lot of advice to them with regard to priorities, other than when we're underneath the, for example, underneath the state trail acquisition, those that had the highest priority, in my opinion, are at the top. Those that have the lowest, it keeps on going down. So if they have to start cutting off dollars, that would kind of be the sequence that we would I would expect them to take. But how we compare, trying to prioritize other activities in here. For example, landfill closing, closure hours versus WMAs or whatever. That's something that we can discuss to see if we want to refine that more or if it's really not possible for us to do that and just send this on to capital investment, with the caveat that we'd really appreciate it when they go to, when they find out what their dollar amounts are and what they're going to actually be able to support the environment with, that they would ask for our advice on how to maybe craft that final document. Then it will go from there to Ways and Means and into the floor. So.
If I could.
Representative Wiggins.
Yes. Is it therefore your intention to do this tonight, since we've just seen this document and your suggestions and we haven't had time to digest your suggestions?
That would be my hope. Because we have had all the bills before us and we've kind of gone through them and asked questions in details, now we're just kind of looking at the dollar amounts and which ones line up, and we'll just have to see how it goes. I'm not locked into any specific procedural outcome, but if we don't do it tonight, we'd have to be back and make sure that we're doing this first thing in the morning. So it's
why does it have to be done this week?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to fit into any deadline I've heard of.
The capital investment sent around notices to everyone that they had to were due to be finished. Some of them have already been finished. I think about four or five of the committees have already finished their capital investment recommendations, or two capital investments. So we're kind of in the middle of the group. There's some more that we'll be following next week. Mr. Reynolds.
Mr. Chairman, then I'll just run through in outline for the committee the proposal dollar amount, starting on the first page with the Department of Natural Resources. The proposal is for $23,600,000 in the flood hazard mitigation grants. That would include, as I said a little just a minute earlier, House File 2182 and House File 2345, the Red Lake Watershed District and the Cannon Falls bills that came before the committee. And going down the proposal one column, the next item recommended in this would be the dam repair, reconstruction, and removal projects of the DNR is recommended at $1,200,000. That would include the governor's recs and also House File 2123, removal of the Rush Creek Dam. The next item would be the RIM critical habitat match, recommended at $2 million for bonding. The RIM wildlife area acquisition project, recommended at $12 million, which matches what the governor's rec was on that item. And the fisheries acquisition and improvement project, recommended at $1 million, slightly less than the governor's. Water access and fishing pier development is recommended at $3 million. Stream protection is at $500,000, the same as both the bill and the governor's rec. Metro Greenways is recommended at $1 million, which is the same as the governor's rec. A native prairie bank easements recommended at $1 million. The SNA's project is recommended at $300,000. State trail acquisition and development, I'm tripping on that word, is recommended at $5,700,000. That then would include the governor's rec and then the items listed over in the far right column, which would be the Paul Bunyan Trail, the Excelsior Road Bridge at $1.5 million, the riprap at Lake Bemidji at $400,000 on the Paul Bunyan Trail, and $500,000 on the Paul Bunyan Trail for work in the city of Bemidji. That was House File 2130. Shooting Star State Trail is included at $450,000. The Forestville segment of Bluffland State Trail at $450,000. The Goodhue Pioneer Trail at $200,000. And the St. Louis Park pedestrian bridge over County 8 Highway 25 is recommended at $500,000, and a partial recommendation of $200,000 for removal of the old Cedar Avenue Bridge are individual items within that total trail dollar amount. Moving on, the next item would be the fish hatchery improvements at $1,700,000. The Rim Wildlife Management Area development at $300,000. State Forest land at $1 million. State Forest roads and bridges at $300,000. State Park acquisition at $2 million. State Park building development is at $5.8 million. It includes the Governor's Rex plus Big Bog State Park, which was House File 2080, and Grand Portage State Park, which building, which was House File 1834 at the numbers indicated, the 1.3 and 1.5 million. Next item would be local initiative grants funded at $2.5 million. These are the local parks, SNA, and trail grants. One item is recommended to be listed in the riders is House File 1996, the Crosby Parkland in South St. Paul grant at $500,000. State asset preservation in the DNR is $2 million. Field office renovation at $500,000. Office facilities development at $2 million. Lake Superior Zoo grant, House File 1747 at $400,000. And the North Shore State Parks reforestation at $400,000. That is a total of $70,200,000 for the DNR. Approximately $3 million more than the governor's recommendation for that agency. On page two, the first agency would be the Pollution Control Agency. The only project was the closed landfill bonding request from the governor at $14 million. The proposal is the same at $14 million. In the Office of Environmental Assistance, the capital assistance program was recommended by the governor at $4 million. This proposal is at $5.8 million. The bill that came became before the committee, House File 1922, is included partially in both of those, along with the other projects listed in the governor's rec. The Water and Soil Resources Board, the RIM Reserve and CREP program is listed as $2 million for general fund. That is the administration dollars utilized by the agency and the local agencies for administration. The bonding amount is recommended at $20 million, which is the same as both the governor and the bills that came before the committee in the recommendation. The local government road wetland replacement is recommended at $4,362,000, which was the amount that came for the committee from the governor's rec. The Minnesota Zoo Master Plan is recommended at $18 million. Asset preservation at the zoo is recommended at $2 million. Debt forgiveness is recommended to be adopted. That is a general fund expenditure of $1,700,000 in fiscal year 05, excuse me. The Met Council Regional Parks bonding recommendation is at the same as the governor at $7 million. The total then is, as I said, $1,444,369, broken out into those general fund and general obligation bond dollars as indicated.
And if we go back on page one, there are some items that did not include support for that was in the governor's recommendation, and that is in the top third about of the page is reforestation. That was in the governor's recommendation for $3 million, as well as down towards the bottom third of the it says county forest reforestation at $1 million. And it's my understanding that both of those programs are new to the bonding process, and therefore we, in this time, we decided not to start a new way of funding those efforts, but they should continue through the general fund as they have in the past. And then, Lake Superior's Safe Harbors, further down on the page, was $2 million. That is the McQuaid Landing Safe Harbor facility. Fairly controversial, and have not been able to resolve that controversy, and I felt that we could we had higher priorities, seeing that that land has been secured, and we're talking about a facilities at that point. And so I'm recommending that we use those dollars to backfill in some other areas. The local initiative grants, which is right below there, was zero in the governor's recommendation, and I'm recommending that we put in $2,500,000. And then all the, even though we're earmarking $500,000 towards the South St. Paul effort, what all of those programs, as well as others that are in the local initiative grant programs, would be eligible to compete in that process for the bonding support, bonding dollar support. And as I understand, the local initiative grant program and underneath DNR is a matching program, so we'd be getting local dollar matches as well as providing some state support for those local initiatives, and that the DNR has a prioritization process that they use. I know that LCMR has funded local initiative grants in the past program, and we've been quite happy with the results there, so I thought we'd that was really a better way to go than try to pick and choose losers in the process. But I did think South St. Paul should get started in trying to recover that area as best possible. And then, let's see, I think the only other change that I wanted to bring to your attention is in the Minnesota Zoological Gardens, recommending $18 million instead of $19 million. And my logic there was is that I understand that there is not only the exhibits that they want to get put in place, but there was approximately $1 million that was being earmarked for a warehouse, and I feel that we really need to focus on the exhibit. And the asset preservation is a critical component, but providing $2 million for trying to for the next 2 years to help with those assets in preserving them, I think is a significant step forward, and I don't and I felt that that was adequate to deal with that particular issue, although there is a significant amount of deterioration there that does need to be fixed. So we should be looking at providing more asset preservation dollars in the future. It's not something that this is a one-time fix. This is just kind of to get us past through this next 2 years, in my opinion. That kind of puts together some of the logic that I've used in trying to come up with priorities by recognizing that several of these areas we're trying to enhance and leave some decision in the current processes, like in local initiative grants and so forth. So we can take advantage of some of that, where they're trying to, you know, sort out each one of these items separately, let them go through an established process. So that's the recommendations that I have, and if members have questions that you'd like to. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. We heard a governor's recommendation, I think, of $10 million for sewage. Am I to assume that that is in Representative Gunther's bill?
I believe so, yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, that PFA funding is being dealt with in Representative Gunther's Committee on Economic Development and Finance.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, that has a profound impact on waters. Do we know if Representative Gunther is going to put that in his bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, he has not taken action on their recommendations, so I don't think we know at this time what it will be. I think that that is a high priority from the testimony that I've heard with that committee.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have some question about these ones that were dramatically cut down, and what's supposed to happen with them if there's some reason behind them. One of them is the Lencheski Bloomington Cedar Avenue bridge removal, and from 900,000 to 200,000, what's supposed to happen for 200,000 in that?
I wanted to try and indicate that that is an important action needs to take place. I'm still very frustrated that this is not a MnDOT project, that this falls into the environmental area. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to continue to talk about that as this particular item moves through the bonding process. I wanted to have an indication there that it is a priority item.
I don't remember, so I'll put this as a question. Was this going to be accessible for whatever the newest version of the T21 and so forth funds in, the alternative grants in the federal highway funding, and what department that goes through?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, they
T21 was its last name. I'm not sure what it is. IC was the first one. I don't know what it is this year. Since they change it every year, it must have a different year name this year.
They did not testify that they had applied for money to that program for this. I think that they probably could, whether it would be approved or not. You know, there's way more projects applying. I think they would have to apply for it as demolition and then rebuilding at the same time, probably, to get a favorable ruling or approval under that program. But it's certainly, from what I know of it, it could be eligible for those funds.
But it seems to me that it also ought to be there are several levels. There's the absolute transportation level and then the kind of accessory type level. It seems to me that this one, knowing that area, this would fall into the total transportation
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I believe it, and Representative Kahn, I think that was part of the thought there was there are other sources of funds that could be used to get to the total, and we would keep this in conversation by giving some of the funds for it.
Okay, but I know that there are a lot of difficult decisions to be made, and with really good requests and but I'm kind of a little surprised that none of the requests from either Minneapolis or St. Paul made it into this, at any level. I may be missing some, but I just don't see any of them. And again, when you're looking at the population distribution and the need for those, I think they ought to have some share of some of this bill. And I'm talking about some of the planning to start some of the trail connections and then the Meeker Island site and that sort of thing. Why are those just totally, why is Minneapolis and St. Paul totally eliminated from this?
It was Representative Kahn. It was not done intentionally other than just looking at the projects and trying to see what seems to be the biggest bang for our buck in the process. If you have some suggestions that you'd like us to review, I'd be glad to discuss it and see what we can come up with.
Well, I would say the two highest areas of use, and I'd hate to... the one that I had was merely to start the planning for it, but the connection, that Grand Round Parkway has got to be the highest level of usage, and it's not only of usage as recreation, it's just very heavy usage as commuter. And in terms of total recreation, the Lake of the Isles issue, now that's a very big number, and I don't know if there was anything that made sense with a smaller number, but just in terms of numbers of people, and I heard many other projects that are not being funded in this that I also thought were valuable, but those are just two projects that I know of because of just the heavy usage that doing them would facilitate, probably more than anything else that's on the list.
That particular program, the House File 2154, is $250,000. It's underneath the local initiative grants. And if you'd like, we can make a rider recommending that be funded.
There is a problem with the local initiative grants, and I've dealt with this in the past, is that they've got, unless it's been changed, there's a limit. So an expensive project has trouble getting through that because there's a limit which doesn't take into account the numbers of people or the size of the community that's looking for it and so forth. So I don't know. I don't know if Wayne is here. If someone could speak to what happens, like what the limit is on that now.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Osmond, my name is Cordelia Pearson. I work with the Trust for Public Land and working with the Minnesota Recreation Park Association and others on the bill that included local initiative grants. The Natural and Scenic Area Grant is a grant program which all communities throughout Minnesota, including St. Paul and Minneapolis, are eligible for their non-regional parks, so their local parks within the system. And the limit was used to be 100 or 200,000. It's been increased to 500,000. Okay. So it would be able to pay for a project getting 50-50 match that was up to $1 million. So it really did substantially improve the program's it could help communities get their projects done more feasibly. Is that helpful?
Does that include trails? Does that project include trails?
The trails program, I think, has a $100,000 limit for local trails. Local trails would be those connecting to either regional systems or connecting to a local park. So it's about getting people to another park or natural area or other trail. And that's $100,000. That's lower.
So, again, that project does bump up against that limit.
And that's a trail project?
Yeah, well, it's the scenic, it's connecting the Grand Rounds, the final link of what we call the Grand Rounds.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up? I thought it fell under the $1 million, Representative Kahn. I actually thought your first description would allow the project to be up to $1 million.
Members of the committee, that I'm unfamiliar with the Grand Rounds, if that's actually part of the regional park system.
No, it's actually not.
It's not? Okay.
It's not. The part that needs to be connected is actually not part of the regional park system. It is a connecting to.
I can check on that and get back to the committee members if that's of interest.
No.
Would that be helpful?
We're doing some checking ourselves right now. Other concerns while we're trying to find out about that question, Representative Kahn, do you have other? You've mentioned, you said there was others that you were concerned about.
Well, the Lake of the Isles, that is part of the regional park system, and that's, of course, a huge amount. So, again, I don't know if there's any point. Oh, and then there was another question that I brought up in general, and I don't know if you want to, is that some of these projects, if we have big, I think we have, big reserves in things like both the Game and Fish Fund and in the Water Recreation Fund. And what if we decided that we'd pull down those reserves and bond some, and those funds usually we only appropriate from. But what if we pulled down those reserves and did some bonding from some of those? That would then free up general fund bonding for other things, and we get, you know, the argument for bonding using those funds is just as good as the argument for bonding using general fund dollars. And that anything that's going to be effective over a long period of time, you ought to do it right. You know, and particularly if it's anything that has to do with acquisition, you just get a much bigger bang for your buck if you do it right at front and pay it off over time instead of, you know, building roads an inch at a time as we collected the money. And that would then, if we started using those funds for backing some of those funds, and I just mentioned those two because I think they have very big reserves, much bigger reserve than we seem to think we need for the state general fund. So if we started to do some bonding with those, you know, there are a bunch of these things which would clearly fit the water, you know, anything I think that had to do with dam repair, reconstruction, and removal, and certainly the Meeker Trails, the Meeker Dam site, which is there, and anything that has to do with access piers, wherever they are, fishing access and piers, if we could do much more of those.
Before you start spending the money, let's talk about whether it's even available.
Okay.
As I understand, even though there may be from time to time some balances, high balances in those accounts, they do go down significantly over the period of time to take care of the needs that those accounts were established for.
Wow.
So those funds are not do not carry, as I understand it, because we checked, you brought this up about 3 weeks ago, sometime 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, mm-hmm. and we checked on it and was advised that it's not possible for us to do that. But Mr. Reinholz may have some more information on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I did, when you brought it up, it was related to the PCA grants or
okay.
funds, and I did look at those and did come back and say, yeah, they are, most of them are not flush with money, especially when you
okay.
go out a few years, as we usually try to keep track of. We don't have a lot of money to do that. Specifically on the game and fish in that and the natural resources, those do have some balances, but much of it is in dedicated areas in that, and you know the difficulty of spending dedicated accounts for uses other than what they were dedicated for.
I'm only looking at uses that they would be dedicated for. There are items in that fit into what those dedicated funds would be. And the other advantage is, too, is if you've bonded to do something, so you do it right away, that means that the funds won't go down in the same way in which they would, because the reason they're going down is that you're using them to appropriate to do things.
Mr. Chairman,
if you bond instead of, if you bond, what you're doing is you're paying debt service over a longer period of time. So
right.
that means as opposed to appropriating to doing projects.
There's
so the funds will last a lot longer when you do that. I know you pay more, but the point is you get it done right away, and you also, you know, you have to look at the, when you add the things that change, like the present value of money and the value of land, you know, particularly when it's an acquisition thing, it's very likely that you come out way ahead by bonding for some of these things rather than just doing them by appropriations.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, you're correct. You are, but there are very, very few items that are actually paid for, capital projects that are paid for out of operating appropriations of the game and fish. I was trying to think of what your example would be.
No, I'm saying that if there is a reserve, you could use them. We haven't used these funds to back bonds.
Right.
And, well, the Water Recreation Fund, we definitely do. We definitely do capital projects from that. Water Recreation Fund, we certainly do. And Game and Fish Fund, we certainly do things with fishing piers and access and things like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I may be wrong, but I don't believe we use Game and Fish Funds for fishing piers construction or very few, because the agencies, as you know, have been tight on operating budgets, and most of
okay.
the capital spending items have disappeared from there and are they reliant
okay.
upon the bonding to do those items. There may be some, and I would have to check, but there that specifically there are some, because there is this small game surcharge which is earmarked towards purchasing WMA lands. That's already being done, you know, those types of things, but they're very minor. I don't think there's very much in the game of fish, though.
Well, let's even look at that small game surcharge. So we have the small games, and maybe we should do some more things. I probably don't want to do it on the bonding bill this year, but maybe we should do some more things like small game surcharge brings in how much, and do we use that just for appropriated money? Do we use that just for appropriations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I believe so right now.
Well, just the perfect example. That's dedicated for the acquisition of wildlife management. If we use it for bonding, we could dramatically accelerate the use of that fund. If instead of using it for appropriations, we use it for debt service on bonds, we could do very much more of it. And if we're doing it in place, and if we're looking at both the value of land and the value of money going up, we could accomplish very much more using the same money if we use it for bonding instead of for appropriating. And I think the same thing is true with parts of the Water Recreation Fund.
We can pursue those concepts in another year, but I don't think it's going to work for this year. Other questions?
It's not going to work tonight, but you could.
Pardon?
It's not going to work tonight, but you're going to. This it's a long time before we get to the final bonding bill.
You have a much closer relationship with the chair of capital investment than I do. So
only when we're trying to cut things.
What's the matter here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'll be able to follow on that or not. In regards to state forest land acquisition, we have in there $1 million, and we have not earmarked. I know in the governor's proposal there was talk of 5 different projects, 2 of them in the Sand Dunes Park. Since this came out, we heard about the project that was presented by Representative Hoppe on behalf of Representative Howes. And it was a very neat project. I was just wondering, are we not going to, and I know there was controversy about how much was really needed, and I think we were looking into it was going to be less than $1 million because really the total was 934, if I remember right. Were we going to consider earmarking that project, or was it just to let it up to DNR? What was the thoughts there?
We were, Representative McNamara's, the intent is to leave it up to DNR. In their process. Mr. Reynolds, do you have any additional information on that?
Mr. Chairman, no, you're correct there. We're not limiting the DNR. The DNR could choose to do that, I believe, if they thought that was the wise use of the funds.
Okay, thank you.
Where is that one on the list?
About 3/4 of the way down.
Yeah.
But you've earmarked
state forest land acquisition.
You've earmarked $1 million of it, though.
Yes, we okay. Funded the million. Same as the governor's rec.
Oh, I see.
Could I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Mr. McNamara.
Along the same thing, is that then would be in the OEA, the Demmer bill for $4 million, the same thing? We're doing 5.8 to OEA with the possibility of the... the Rochester facility was a neat one, and it certainly could come out of the 5.8. Would that be the same situation?
Mr. Reynolds?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. We left that one up. The OEA, I think the rationale was the OEA has a very good system of going through and rating the projects and putting the money into the projects as they are ready for it. And they, in conversation with them, all the projects that were listed, at this level, all the projects that were listed on their high list, which included that Red Wing one, also the Rochester, the Olmsted, the one in Rochester and the Southwest, would all receive funds. We aren't earmarking how much funds, but they believe they all would receive funding at this level.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara, we did try to add a few more dollars there because the Rochester facility was in the bonding bill 2 years ago. They got vetoed. And so recognizing that, we tried to make a few more dollars there to make sure that they could try to fund as much as possible. But didn't want to get into too much of a pick and choose. they really seemed to have a good program to be able to do that on their own. Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to express my disappointment about Representative Hoppe's proposals to expand the Native Prairie Bank easements and the SNA acquisition. I mean, these are relatively small amounts of money that in this bill. And this is Minnesota's heritage. And I had asked DNR about how much Native Prairie we have. And my guess is, since I never have gotten the answer on that, but my guess is it's less than 50,000 acres that is under, less than 50,000 acres that is set aside in one way or another and will not be go under the plow in some way. That's a very small amount of money when we are, or a small amount of acreage, when we seem to have a consensus that when we redevelop, we want to go native. And you have to have a variety of seed stock, not just the genetics from one little area, but you have to have a variety in order to make sure that we can even maintain or restore. I look at that and I say, is that more important than an office facility development on the third from the bottom? And the, well, you can do office facility developments just about any time because they're always offices. And I would ask you if you would consider revisiting that and thinking more about some of the arguments that Representative Hoppe made.
Thank you, Representative Williams.
No. So happy.
I just wanted to say thank you.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative McNair.
Thank you. And, you know, the one thing, Representative Wagenius, you and I both have a great love for Native Prairie. I think the one thing we have to put into context, unfortunately, we lost a lot of our original Native Prairie. But huge, huge tracts are being restored. Part of it, potentially, if we get this CREP deal worked out, will be a lot of acres restored to Native Prairie. So I think that really the Native Prairie, a lot of it's being developed on private property. You know, the State Farm site out in Woodbury, is the whole grounds is Native Prairie now. It's an urban area. A lot of places are developing Native Prairie. So I really think we're over the hump of a lot of the seed source issues also. A whole industry has developed in that. I would have rather seen more there, too. I'd rather, like all of us probably here, would have seen more. But I really think that we really, there's been a lot of really positive things in the Native Prairie area. And I think this will opportunity for some of the original to be restored. But I count a lot of the developed new Native Prairie as very positive.
Could I respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Senator Wagenius.
I also count restoration as a positive, but restoration needs genetic diversity. And that is one of the reasons you want to make sure that you have more native populations than we have currently that are set aside, that are absolutely native populations. Because, I mean, I love to see a field of bluestem, but I want the native variety, because we don't have an authentic prairie without the variety and the intensity. And if you will listen to some of the folks at the U talk about the prairie, it is actually biologically healthier when it has all of the variety and it's all tight. And I look down and look at the Rim Wildlife Management Development Area, and I see $300,000, and I think, if I'm right, Mr. Chair, that that is for the redevelopment of the Rim Wildlife Area acquisition. So we're spending $20 million on acquisition, which is, no, I'm sorry, $12 million on acquisition, which is okay. But we're only spending $300,000, and I think this is the money to redevelop those, the $12 million that we are acquiring. Am I right about that?
The $12 million for the WMAs?
The Rim Wildlife Area Acquisition.
Yes. That's the WMA.
Right.
Wildlife Management Areas.
Okay. And then we have down for the development of it. The governor asked for $600,000, and we're providing three. And that is, that's the kind of the other side. We've said, and I think we've gotten a consistency in folks talking about it, that we do want to make sure that those places are put in back to native species. And my guess was $600,000 is pretty minimal to start with. So that's my second concern. The first that Minnesota has not much of its native heritage left, and we should be doing what we can, particularly since we know we can use that genetic diversity to do some other things we want to do, which we've all, I do hear a consistency on this committee, and that we look at this development of the lands that we are acquiring. So those are the two areas of concern, neither of which are in my district, so I'm not arguing this for my district. It is more preserving this for the children and the grandchildren.
Representative McGinnis, on the Native Prairie Bank easements, of course, as you know, just the easement programs alone across the state of Minnesota are in a very controversial situation right now, and so we'd like to try and get some type of resolution to that. I'm hoping to retain or maintain what we currently have in the governor's proposal. To take the dollars from the office facilities development, if you looked at that in the book, you see that that is a facility that needs to be replaced. It's in the Glenwood Consolidated Field Office, and they have life safety, asbestos, lead paint, and bat doo-doo issues that they've got to deal with out there. And we reduced it from $2,300,000 down to $2 million, so we're trying to get them to tighten the belt on it, but really felt that that was a request that was a reasonable one, and that, as they explained it, did have some immediacy to trying to resolve. So that's the reason I made the selections that I did. Representative Wiggins.
Yes, I remember hearing the testimony of that, and I do see the immediacy. That's been sitting there, and it will sit there another 2 years. Some of the prairies that we have won't be there in 2 years, and that's my concern. And from if I remember my testimony correctly, there is more available for acquisition than we are purchasing.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. You may find this question perplexing. How would I go about it? First question, Ms. Chairman, is the money in the SNA acquisition, the $300,000, is that earmarked at this point for any specific SNAs, or is that in general for the DNR to it's just in the program?
That's correct.
Okay, Ms. Chairman, how would a person go about doing something to keep the SNAs from being established in certain counties? I thought you might find that an interesting request. I'm not requesting it. I just want to know how we would do that. I mean, you know, I have, Mr. Chairman, I have a 1,200,000 acre SNA in my district, and I'm just concerned that, you know, we recently had a very controversial SNA be established there without any public hearings, without any public input. The DNR just used the money and went about doing it. And so I'm just, this is merely a fact thing. Anyone thinks that I'm going to propose it, I'm just trying to learn something here in the legislature. Oh, you're proposing it? Anyway, could I hear something about that?
Representative Gill, the way we do that is like with regard to the Grand Portage State Park, for example. What we're going to do is put a rider into the Bonneville that earmarks those dollars for a specific project.
Okay.
Now, if you had some direction with regard to SNA and you wanted to put some direction to the department, we just add rider language.
Yeah, okay. So we wouldn't codify it. You just make it into a rider language.
Yes, and I don't know exactly how that, Mr. Reinholz, how does that, I know it affects the dollars that we're allocating in this bill. I don't know if it has implications on future spending. What happens to those riders in the future?
Mr. Chairman, most of them expire with the dollars. Right. It would depend somewhat on how it's written, but I would envision you'd say none of the appropriation above could be used to purchase land in whatever county. I'm not. If you wanted it to be permanent, I believe you would want to codify it somewhere in the actual statutes related to SNAs.
Again,
probably before you'd want to do that, you may want to discuss it with DNR and see what type of what their thinking is as to where they have this money earmarked for or identified to go to see if you're even running into that type of problem, because the language that we put in a rider is limited in its duration, so you're probably better off dealing right with the department.
Well, Mr. Chairman, far be it for me to try and do anything controversial, like an uncased gun law or anything, but just thank you for the information.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on my previous comments, you could fund from using bonding from either the water account or the game and fish fund. You could fund, instead of GO bonds, the RIM part of the RIM critical habitat match, the RIM wildlife area acquisition, and the water access and fishing piers. You could then free up a chunk of general fund money from that and then go on and do, and I'm glad Representative Wagenius pointed them out because those would be my high priorities too. You could then put additional chunk of money into the three HOPI proposals. You know, that is the kind of way you could. Now, as I said, you're obviously not prepared to do that tonight, but it's the kind of thing that could be thought about, since those programs do have some funding. As you go through the process and people are trying to work this around, to keep that in mind, that there could be other sources of funding.
Mr. Khan, do you serve on capital investment?
No.
I understand what you're trying to accomplish.
See,
before I'd be able to get into, we're talking about a process here that would need to have a considerable amount of discussion in several different areas for us to try and establish that. I'm also leery as to what would happen with our creativeness as it gets into the rest of the process.
Chairman, if you remember,
we find it all vaporized, and all of a sudden we have dollars that we thought was going to go towards environment is now backfilling because they took the bond dollars that are actually proposed today and spending it on something entirely outside of the realm of environment and natural resources. So I think there's considerable risk in doing what you're suggesting.
Well, if you remember, Mr. Chairman, I used to chair the division that had these funds in them, along with people like former Representative Carlson and former Representative Battaglia, and we were well known for our ability to do creative funding, some of which actually made it through the process. I think that was one of the reasons why that was broken up. but it was good while it lasted. But we did a very good job of creative funding.
You not only had creativity, who had control? We don't really have that.
Well, we never had control. We just acted it.
We have creativity, but we lack control. And I'm afraid if we put too much on the chopping block, we could end up having a net negative impact to our environmental efforts. So I'd want to be assured that that would not be a potential, and I'm afraid it would be. Are there other questions that members have? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Khan and Representative Wagenius, I appreciate your comments, and I think most of us in this room would like to fund all the projects that we have in front of us. And I, you know, at this point, and we've already started working on it, I'm happy these projects got funded to the governor's recommendations. Do I wish it was more or less? I'm happy they're funded, and I think now we need to start being creative and working on the next committees that this is going to go through and make sure we maintain the funding that we have. So we'll do what we can, and I agree with you and appreciate your sentiments. And looking at all the things that weren't able to get funded, I'm happy that they're funded at the governor's recommendation.
Other comments from members? Questions? Senator Tingleston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is to Mr. Reinholz. I'm wondering, of these projects that we have on our list here, how much matching funds that might be accessed. I realize we don't have that now, but maybe if we could get that information at some point, that this leverages, $200 million or whatever the number is, think that might be helpful into the next committee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tingelstad, it is significant. The CREP dollars obviously has a large federal match that would go along with it, is one of the largest ones. OEA has large amounts of local match, and I can put that together for some backup documentation for the Capital Investment Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn, your comments earlier about the Minneapolis Grand Round Byway, I'm wondering if we would like to earmark that $250,000, and we can put in notwithstanding language to deal with any type of limitations that might be on that particular account. At least I would assume we can.
Well, I would like that if we could.
Members, I would suggest that we move $250,000 into the earmarking under the local initiative grants for the Minneapolis Grand Round Byway. Any objections to that?
Is that here at the bottom? Is it Kahn? Yeah. No? Mr. Chair? Is that Representative Kahn?
Yes.
Near the bottom? Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, would that take money from one of the other projects on here?
No.
What it does is take.
Just clarifying, sorry.
That's right, Representative Hoppe. It's a good question. What it's doing is saying that the $2.5 million that we have for local initiative grants, that out of that $2.5 million, at least $250,000 goes towards this effort.
Thank you.
It's just like the same with the South St. Paul Port Crosby Parkland. It's earmarking $500,000 out of that same $2.5 million to go towards that effort. But the other dollars will be available for the normal process of the local initiative grants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, it's my intention that the items that we have on the side where we have selected dollar amounts that we're earmarking that come out from underneath, say that the state trail acquisition funds or the local initiative grants, that we will direct staff to provide rider language to implement those recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee as displayed on the spreadsheet, so that they'll take care of that language for us in the process.
And
if there's no objection. Representative Kahn.
I'm obviously grateful, but let me suggest for all of those the language of some approximate number be used. You know, I don't know if we're going to use an up to or something like that, because this is planning money, so, you know, or just maybe as it will.
Okay, so we don't earmark more than what is absolutely needed?
That maybe they'll come in with a plan where they can do it with less, too. So
we can handle that in the rider language. Any other questions that members have on the proposal? Representative Tingelstad.
Perhaps to Mr. Reinholtz, for when it moves into capital investment, the items that don't have any dollar figure in the column called Proposal 1 or included in main, that column, so they're basically ones that our committee is not recommending or not funding with this total here. Will that still appear on what goes to capital investment, or will that drop off after this committee? How will that be handled?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tingelstad, normally if it was not a governor's rec, it would not. It certainly could be sent on to them. And we did have some discussion of sending that on so that we can display and show to that committee that decisions were made and not all projects were passed on. That decision hadn't been made yet, but that certainly is possible to do it that way if the chair and the members thought that was useful in dealing with capital investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as any kind of like ranking or I just got off of the Capital Investment Committee, and I see that some of the other finance committees that have done the capital investment do a committee priority called neutral or yes or no, or they do a full ranking from 1 to 30, or I'm just wondering if we have any plans to do any additional fine-tuning of this before it goes to that committee.
Representative Tingelstad, are they doing that for all items or just the items above the governor's recommendation, or what?
Mr. Chair, from what I've seen, it's for all items.
Because it, to me, the priorities are pretty clearly established when we actually fund them. I think that those are our top priorities, and that. So I don't know what else they would, if they're only just saying that they, giving a kind of a category. If they're actually doing a 1 to 100 type of prioritization, that's going to be really. We're going to be here a long time trying to do that. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing that that's useful, and I think it still exists, this was another one of those Kahn-Krinke collaborations, which gets everyone so nervous. I think it still exists in the rules, but it was if the subject matter committee wanted a no on something, then that it could not then be reinstated by the Capital Investment Committee. It can come in later, I guess. It can come in ways and means, and it can. And I assume that that's still in. And I know on the other Finance Committee, there was one thing that we very strong, at least one thing that we very strongly felt no on, and that was a governor's proposal to demolish the Ford Building. And so that was the one thing that we put a no on, and the only effect that I look at this, I'm not sure I see anything that I feel. The other things may mean something. I think this, as opposed to that committee, which only has a few things, this one has enough that I think just funding it is enough. And it's not, unless there's anything that somebody sees that they think deserves the no classification, and I'm not sure I do. I hope.
It's my understanding, Representative Kahn, that we do have that authority, but as you recognize it, pretty limited. We put a no on it, it goes to capital investment, and then when it goes from there to ways and means, it can be put back in, it can be put back on the floor, it can come in from the Senate. So it's nothing that has any lasting impact other than sending a strong message from the committee that this is really not a good idea.
Right. But and that's what that other committee wanted to do, but I don't see, at least I don't see anything I want to do on this.
That was my feeling also. I didn't see anything that jumped out at me as an absolute no. Matter of fact, many of them, I just wish we had more than we could really do, and so that's why it was difficult to try and come up with a recommendation, but I tried to cover the areas that I thought was people that had testified to where the highest needs were and where we could really try to have the biggest bang for our dollars. Any other comments or questions on the recommendations? Members, we have before us in recommendations in a spreadsheet format. I'll wait for Mr. Reinholz to come back before I continue. He has to hear what I say. So.
Mr.
There he is.
Just a follow-up to Representative Tingelsted. So our fears, when it goes to capital investment, we're going to leave it up to their latitude. I mean, they'll either add the projects they like above our recommendations, or if they went the other direction, or if they went the more probable other direction, are we not going to give them direction in what we thought might be our strongest ones to save?
We certainly can attempt to do that if you'd like. They have asked us to give them as much information as possible with regard to what you want to lose. They haven't asked us to give them any recommendations on what we'd like to have added. But they, there is something that has weak support, it's low priority. We certainly can include that in our communications to the Capital Investment Committee.
Matter
of fact, I think that they're expecting something along that line. Representative Kahn?
Who do we have on capital investment from here? Two. Okay, we got two tough guys. They'll take care of it.
We'll carry the water for you, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chair.
Should not be imperative.
Because we have so many freshmen on the committee here, maybe if you could talk about what will happen at the next point, because I know you'll present at capital investment, and maybe you know the committee's not aware of that, or they should come that day and listen to the presentation.
That's it. When we come to a conclusion as to what we want to have for our recommendations given to capital investment, I'm anticipating that will include the dollar amounts. It will include if we have recommendations on where the soft areas are that they should, if they're going to reduce, what we'd actually recommend that they look at first. And then We'll also have our riders on there for language that we would like to have included for earmarking dollars to go from one category to a specific project. And so that we'll be presenting that to Capital Investment. They then do a process similar to what we're doing. Someone or the committee or a group or the chair will put together recommendations and present them to the Capital Investment Committee. They then, when they have an agreement, will then pass that on in the form of a bill, a bonding bill, to Ways and Means. And then it will be debated in Ways and Means, added, subtracted, go to the floor of the House, added, subtracted, and then it will go into conference committee. So that's kind of the process that we have on the bill. The difference on this particular bill is to pass a bonding bill, you have to have how many votes? 81. You think it's 81 votes?
Yes.
So it's a significant team effort. This is one of the areas where we all have to kind of come together and try to put good quality projects in and get something done. Representative Kahn.
Interesting, Mr. Chairman. The concept of 81 votes for a bonding bill was perceived that they should be harder to pass than a regular bill because of that. The effect of needing the 81 votes is that the bonding bills grow. They grow till you get 81 votes for them. You think it's easier to pass a smaller bill than a big bill, but that's just not, and that's true in everything except bonding. In bonding, it's easier to pass a bigger bill than a smaller bill, but you guys will see that as you do it.
We're going to need your help to get there, I tell you that. Any other questions or concerns on raised before we start dealing with the process from here on? What I'd recommend is that we agree to what's on the spreadsheet, and then give the staff the authorization to have the language drafted up for the appropriate writers, and then that will be then communicated or transmitted to the Capital Investment Committee. And I believe we're actually scheduled to have this presented in Capital Investment on Tuesday.
Wednesday.
Pardon? Yes, we'll email everyone at the exact time. We'll also, as soon as it's available, get this entire document with regard to whatever we're going to communicate to Capital Investment to you, so that you can take a look at that. When do we actually have to put it in their hands?
The day before.
Soon. So we wanted to represent McNamara.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and this is a freshman question. You alluded to the prioritization that was going to be necessary, but I still don't understand. Are we going to submit to you and what we personally think? That was on the other finance committee I did. We just, now that we had, these are our projects, we just numbered them. If there's 20 projects here, 1 through 20, and then they did a compilation to kind of, you know, either advice to you and then you did it at your direction or you compiled them. I'm wondering, where will we do, what's the plan from here? We just should let you know what our thoughts are up and down?
No, I'm hoping that we'll actually, what I'd like to do is get established as to what's on the spreadsheet and get that established. So then we know exactly what projects we're talking about that we're going to be recommending for funding and what levels. And then I will, the next discussion I'd like to put before the committee is how you want to prioritize and how we should do that.
Okay.
But I want to try and get us a baseline or a foundation first so we know what's in, what's out, and we aren't prioritizing first and then kind of get those two issues kind of confused as to what we're doing. So this is first the dollars and cents issues, and what are we going to recommend to be funded or not to be funded?
Mr. Chair, so we may see this again with the riders, Matt, like Tuesday or Wednesday morning. It's afternoon when you have Capital Investments.
Mr. Reinholtz, you have any ideas to how long it take to put everything together?
Mr. Chairman, I think by Monday we could have something in members' hands. Not first thing in the morning, but Monday we would have something that people could see.
Mr. Chair, so would
We'll be taking some.
Actually, once we finish with this today, this is our recommendation to.
Right, and that's what I understood. Stayed within the governor's.
I'm hoping this will be kind of off of our committee platter as of the finished up.
Okay, that's what I.
That doesn't mean that we don't want to continue to have your input, because as I present this, we'd certainly, if you have some other things you'd want to say to capital investments, you're like every other citizen, you have the opportunity to make those comments. If we finished discussing and with regard to everyone's questions have been answered at this point, then I'd like to move that we accept the spreadsheet as currently displayed or currently amended. It was amended with adding $250,000 to the included in the main column for the Grand Rounds Byway in Minneapolis. And otherwise, everything else is as presented. And any comments or questions? And this would be approved in this motion and then recommended to be passed to the, or will be passed to the Capital Investment Committee with the rider language that will be drafted by our staff to meet the recommendations of the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chairman, I just said, do you want to do, with your comments, and I know I follow this fight, do you want to do a no on McCabe Landing, or you don't want to take on the governor?
I don't really think it's necessary.
Just suggesting you might get the votes for that if you want.
My suggestion is to just leave it there. I think we kind of indicated, you know, what we thought would be a better way to spend the dollars. That's an adequate message.
I don't think it'll get back in capital investment.
I don't think so. My sense was that if we had included it, it would have been just burning the dollars. So.
Okay.
Anything else? Everyone understand the motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We are now, we should talk about prioritization. Is there a way that we can communicate priorities to the Capital Investment Committee? I'm wide open for suggestions on this one. Representative Cotton.
Mr. Chairman, my suggestion is not with this complicated package. I think that you're putting the package together, and I think if you prioritize it, the ones at the end are just asking to be chopped off. And I think even though you're not on capital investment, although we do have our two guys who are, they're going to follow it through. They may have to do some negotiation of arranging money around and so forth.
I would agree.
But I suggest that you'll, just because it's so big, you know, if it was really five projects, you could probably easily do it. But this is so big and so complex, I don't think you gain anything except ask the bottom ones to be cut off.
It's interesting at your comments, because as I'm looking at the other capital investment recommendations that have been coming in, it seems to me that they had a much lighter load with regard to number of issues and what was dealing and such different perspectives on what the programs or projects are even about. I mean, there's just no relationship between them, so it's really tough. It's like choosing between your children in some cases as to how you're going to prioritize. Some may find that easier to do than others.
I didn't say that one.
Unless there's an objection or someone has a better idea, I think that that's what I would be willing to go along with also, just not prioritize, just leave the spreadsheet speak for itself. Is there any objection to doing that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing I was the one that brought up, I like Representative Kahn's idea very much, and when I think about it, whatever we put on the bottom, not to identify any members of the next committee it's going to, but there certainly is a possibility one of them there, I think, would look at the bottom and kaboom, and he or she happens to be a very powerful member of that committee. So our two members here going there, I think, will be in a great position to persuade the group there that the whole 144 million should be in. And if not, they'll, I'm sure, be good.
They'll come back.
Yeah. Answer to what?
Or vice versa.
Thank you, Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're going to make a formal motion. Do we have to vote on what you're proposing?
Well, I think that we were asked to make recommendations, that if it's a decision of the committee not to make recommendations, we probably should make that as a motion so that they are...
That was our recommendation. We made it.
Okay, it puts our representatives that will be carrying this in, I would think, in a better position. Now, what's your advice? You're the ones that will be carrying the water, so what's your advice?
Mr. Chair, I just have a comment, and I don't know if it's appropriate before or after we vote on this motion, but I think at one point I heard that this $144 million from the governor's rec was about 22% of the total bonding that the governor recommended.
Correct.
And so, you know, perhaps put together a recommendation that if that bonding package is reduced coming out of the House, that our portion of it still remain 22%. I don't know if that's something to recommend or just a suggestion at the next level.
It's not quite 22% in it, because that includes agriculture.
Okay.
Mr. Reinholz, do you know how much... how much do we have in agriculture basically compared to ours? It's a fairly small amount.
Mr. Chairman, members, agriculture had, I believe in the governor's rec, $18 million. So it would lower ours by probably a couple percent.
We're probably closer to 19-20%.
So is that maybe a recommendation then to capital investment? I don't know.
Well, that $2 gets you a ride on the New York subway, so...
That
and $2 gets you a ride on the New York subway, so whatever you want.
Yeah. I'm comfortable just not going with the recommendation and to put you in a good position. Do you want to have it as a vote, or you just take it as our consensus? Because we have consensus. Yeah. Anyone objecting? Representative Wasson?
No, actually, I'm agreeing. I think, as it's been pointed out, it's very complex, and I know the other bills, spreadsheets that we've seen in... committee were very simple with like 5 or 7 items, and this is I would agree it's probably the best way, and certainly we'll make it a part of a package, the bigger package, and I think it is conducive to pass the whole thing, which I hope we're all in agreement on that.
And taking it as a consensus, I think it'd be fine. Okay. And I think if Mr. Reinholz and Helen, as you're putting these together, I don't know who does what on this sort of thing, but try to, if you can, display it in such a way that makes it easy to for this to be communicated, that would be much appreciated. So if maybe the document can help speak for itself so that they can kind of tell what it is that we try to do here. Whatever your creativity can come up with to help out in that area, I'd love it. Visuals help, and so if the proper display can help us win the arguments. Not that we'll win the arguments, but it can help. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, then, I think as we submit it to capital investment, if we have those numbers on the amount of matching money that leverages, I think that would be helpful too in what we submit to the next committee.
Yes. We can get that. Put that information to you. If there's anything else that members think of that you think we should have in the presentation, the capital investment in the way of information, please get in contact with me. Wide open to your guidance and directions.
Very good idea.
Anything else that we need to carry on in the form of business on this issue, Mr. Reinholz?
Mr. Chairman, no, I believe the motion's been made. It's the recommendations to be forwarded are clear, and John and I will work on drafting language and getting it to the members and yourself as soon as we get it done.
Okay.
Next committee meeting.
Tuesday morning.
Regular time.
Okay.
Now, remember that the policy committee is tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning, 8:30.
Noon 5. We are adjourned.